Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
So, as I've said, we continue our coverage of the Trump inauguration and all that it entails. We've spoken with Stephen Grews, we've spoken with Kenneth Mokgale, we spoke a little bit earlier with Shail Ben-Ephraim, who's a freelance writer, a liberal Zionist, and living in Los Angeles. We're joined now by Brooks Spector. He's editor at the Daily Maverick Association. Brooks, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Well, good morning.
I've been looking forward to speaking to you because I'm interested in your take on the inauguration and everything that it implied.
Well, yesterday gave a whole new definition to the word extraordinary. On one level, of course, it was nothing at all like the events that led up to the inauguration in 2021. There was no riot. There was no mob effort to take over the Capitol building. Things went largely to plan. The cold weather drove the inauguration swearing-in ceremony indoors in the Capitol Rotunda, which cut down, obviously, the number of people who could see it firsthand by orders of magnitude, and which drove the parade such as it might have been indoors in an arena, which is a little weird. It went.
Brooks, are you there? We lost him for a second. I can see that it is reconnecting to him. There we go. Brooks, you there?
Okay. Are you?
Yeah. We can hear you now. Oh, and now we can't, but that's strange because it shows us that you are there.
Hello.
Yeah, there we go. Now we can hear you. You said that it moved it indoors because of the weather.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he gave his inaugural address. These things are usually efforts to unify a nation, to say, look, we had a vigorous, sometimes ugly political battle, but now we turn toward the future and we bind up our nation's wounds, to quote Abraham Lincoln. And this was the opposite. This was basically his campaign speech. With a couple more ruffles and flourishes, but nevertheless, the campaign speech. We're going to wreak vengeance upon this bunch and that bunch, and we're going to steal the Panama Canal back from the people we stole it from in the first place. We're going to do all those things I promised in my campaign and more. And the end result was I was left with a very bitter, sour taste in my throat. This was not an effort to say we're all in this together. This was an effort to say we won, you lost, ha ha.
What about his focus on the future? What I liked about it was it was about the ability to dream. And I was saying a little bit earlier to one of our guests who also a Democrat, I said to him, to some extent it had an Obama-like feel for me, which was, let's dream of the possibilities that can be. Now, whether you agree with everything or not is a different story, but I just want to get your sense of that aspect.
In effect, that there were two speeches there. There was the partisan, rancorous one that I've identified.
Yes.
Which really was out of place, and you can only imagine what it was like to be Joe Biden sitting there listening to that.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
But then there were other little chunks of it that floated around that were like you said, but it's as if there were two different speech writers who'd been shackled together. All right, give me a draft that has both views in it at the same time. One, we're going to beat them up, and the other one, we're going to look forward to the future. But that future feeling was a little eerie too, because it lingered on the ideas of American exceptionalism and manifest destiny and divine providence and things like that, which were probably not out of place in the mouth of, say, a Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama, but which seemed really out of place with a man for whom none of those values have ever appeared to be important.
Right. So the way in which the comments around gender, the comments around the Gulf of America, you referred to the Panama Canal, how are those likely to be? Are those just words, or does that imply a policy for America?
They're just words, but words have the power to become the deed is the problem. And you know, you don't put it this way: you don't say anything you don't mean in a speech like that, even if it's impossible to achieve it. The idea that you'll rename a global geographical feature because you feel you want it that way is risible. I mean, there are millions of atlases and maps and gazetteers and globes all over the world since the 1600s that have called it the Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of de Mexico if you spoke Spanish. And nobody is going to change that willy-nilly just because it sounds better. Renaming of a mountain in Alaska you know, for 30,000 years or so, the Native Americans called Denali, and then in 1900-something or other, was renamed Mount McKinley because of a president who'd been killed. And then when Barack Obama caused it to be renamed back to Denali, now he, Donald Trump, is going to call it Mount McKinley again because he reveres McKinley, because McKinley was one of the fathers of a major set of tariffs back in the late 19th century. Those are the kinds of small-minded gestures that made me feel awkward, concerned, embarrassed. Why am I having to listen to this kind of thing?
Right.
The real problem, I guess, is not even what we've just said. The real problem is there are people in capitals like Moscow and Beijing and Cairo and, you know, Jerusalem and anywhere else you like, that are listening carefully and are dissecting this presentation to try to figure out what exactly it means for us and what exactly is going to transpire.
I guess as we're doing, as we're talking about the impact on South Africa. So, yeah, indeed. Brooks, I do need to leave it there, unfortunately. We are going to end it there. Fascinating, different perspective, which is what this is all about. We bring you all of the views so that you can decide for yourself.